greetings, my friend, I'm your prison cell.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media scape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a five-star review.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things that go about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. This is our Kwanzaa show. Now, Kwanzaa is a non-religious holiday that I have celebrated for decades. Kwanzaa is celebrated from December 26 through January 1st. Each day symbolizes a principle. In English, it's called the Seven Principles of Kwanzaa. In English and Swahili, Emoja, unity, self-determination, Kuja, Chagalia, collective work and responsibility, Ujima, cooperative economics, Ujamaa, purpose, Nia, creativity, Kumba, and the last day of Kwanzaa is faith, Imani. The panelists at Let's Talk About Race picked a news event and connected it and correlated it to the principles of Kwanzaa.
A Kwanzaa theme that I've related to some of the stories from 2023 is Ujima, collective work and responsibility. Of course, this does relate to unions, the remarkable success that they've had, as well as some other important financial things that have been going on, like trust busting, especially against Amazon and the price fixing. There's a lawsuit against them right now that is going to definitely be one to watch, that is connected to this idea of collective work and responsibility, that collectively things get done that one cannot do on one's own. Another aspect, another story that I connected to this theme was something that I've been lamenting for, I suppose, 2 years now, which is the loss of the child tax credit. That was something that we got in the pandemic that cut child poverty in half in 2021. Very, very rarely do you see a program, any kind of government program, that has that kind of immediate impact for the positive. I guess we can do plenty of things that are immediately negative, but immediately showing that much positive impact is really, really remarkable. And that's something that was not renewed in the past couple of years, and we've seen child poverty go back to where it was. And with this idea of collective work and responsibility, that it is our collective job to work on that and to ensure that the children of the next generation are set up for a better future than we grew up with. And that, of course, applies to many things, but the child tax credit was something that we've already had that worked really well that we could work with again. And there's also studies out there to show that the amount of mileage that, you know, the American people, the American, like the good of us all, the mileage that we got out of the child tax credit was significantly more than any of the elite tax cuts, like for businesses and stuff like that, for the 1%. Those don't trickle down, but the child tax credit does trickle up.
Hello, my name is Nia Gray, and I am the faith reporter for Let's Talk About Race. And my favorite principle of Kwanzaa would be principle number 5, which is Nia, and Nia means purpose. I chose purpose as my favorite principle because this year I saw a lack of purpose in the new phenomenon, or maybe not new, but more Americans are starting to believe in the phenomenon of QAnon. I believe QAnon was brought to a lot of people's attention in the January 6th, the relationship with the January 6th insurrection. And since then, Americans, 1 out of 5 Americans believes a QAnon conspiracy theory that the United States is run by a shadow government of rich people who kill children for their blood so that they can fulfill a pact with Satan. And what we found again is 1 in 5 Americans believes that when surveyed, but what's more surprising is that 1 in 4 evangelicals who were surveyed believe some QAnon conspiracy theory. So things like JFK Jr. is going to come from the dead, back from the dead, and run for president with Donald Trump in 2024. So the reason why I picked purpose, because those of us that are people of faith believe that we have a purpose under God to achieve and live a fulfilling and fruitful and helpful life. And I believe with so many people with no direction, no foundation, can really find themselves falling down the rabbit hole of QAnon.
Professor Johnson.
My pick for Kwanzaa is Imani. So I picked something very specific, and that is the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act. It is a bipartisan act. And for once, I feel that focus has returned to doing something for the American people, something that we all will be able to benefit from. There's so much packed into this, like keeping the Affordable Care Act subsidies for another 3 years, the attention to climate change, and there's even a part of the bill that addresses distressed farmers. It was intended to address the discrimination in loans to farmers of color. They somewhat diluted the language, but the money is still there to provide a program, a lending program that's going to help, you know, farmers of color. There's just such a wide variety of wonderful things packed into this bill. It covers Imani because it restores my faith that we can actually get something done for the American people. But I thought Ujima as well, because of the one for our collective work and responsibility and our cooperative economics, because I believe communities of color will benefit from this. The fact that they're looking at very broadly addressing climate control and knowing that a lot of communities of color are the most impacted by pollution, and the idea that some of this can actually benefit and clean up those communities.
Have you heard of the Inflation Reduction Act? The Inflation Reduction Act, aka the IRA, was signed into law by President Biden in August of 2022. This is one of the most significant actions the United States has taken to help the fight against climate change. But what does it do? At its core, it's a bill about investing in the American people as we transition to a green, clean energy economy. It has many measures, including tax policies, investments in clean energy infrastructure, and supporting U.S. families and workers. This is especially crucial for younger generations. More and more Gen Z, especially recent college grads, are facing huge burdens due to student loan debt, lack of workforce openings, and the rising cost of living in the real world. The IRA would create 1.5 million new jobs to combat inflation and promote environmental benefits. Also, there are several benefits to ensuring that we are staying healthier for less, breathing in clean air for less, and relying on fossil fuels for less.
Today, Stephanie Desmond talks to Jerry Anderson, a health policy expert at Johns Hopkins, who has spent decades working on Medicare issues, including the incredibly high price of prescription drugs. They discuss the changes coming to drug pricing as a result of the recent Inflation Reduction Act signed into law by President Biden. Let's listen. Jerry, you are an expert on drug pricing, and that's why I brought you here today. And I'm wondering if you could talk to me about what the new Inflation Reduction Act does, I guess, for Medicare and maybe for everybody else when it comes to seeing drug prices fall.
Sure. It has three major components. The first one is drug companies aren't allowed to raise their prices faster than the rate of inflation. They've been raising prices much faster than inflation, so this will keep drug prices down. The second thing is that the Medicare program can, for a subset of drugs, negotiate the prices directly. And these are drugs which are very expensive and will save billions of dollars in the negotiation. And the third thing is that in the past, Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries have had unlimited out-of-pocket expenses. And now they will be limited to only $2,000 a year. So those are the three major components, and there's hundreds of other components to the legislation.
We're going to move on to Reverend Cecil. Reverend Cecil, which principle of Kwanzaa would you correlate it to a event that occurred in 2022?
I believe I pick Ujima, collective work and responsibility. What I witnessed this year were people coming together and deciding to make change that was necessary. And that means people saying that enough is enough. Through November 22nd, there has been 607 mass shootings in the United States. Now, we know of the deadly shooting of the LGBTQ club in Colorado Springs, where five people were killed. We know of the shooting and the death of 19 children and two adults in the Texas elementary school, which came only 10 days after the racist mass shooting at Buffalo, New York supermarket, killing 10 black people. In the wake of these continuing slaughters, some gun safety legislation has been passed on the federal and local levels. The president signed the Bipartisan Safety Community Act. And that is the first time in nearly 30 years that gun safety legislation has been enacted on the federal level, which includes incentives for states to pass so-called red flag laws that allow groups to petition courts to remove weapons from people deemed a threat to themselves or others. The bill expands an existing law that prevents people convicted of domestic abuse from owning a gun to include dating partners rather than just spouses and former spouses. And it also expands background check on people between the ages of 18 and 21 seeking to buy guns. In my state of Oregon, a grassroots campaign initiated and directed by faith communities led to over 130,000 people signing a ballot initiative to put on the ballot for gun safety. That measure, number 114, passed. It requires a permit from law enforcement for people to purchase firearms. Applicants would need to complete safety training and pass a criminal background check. And the measure also prohibits magazines capable of holding more than 10 rounds of ammunition. And Oregon will join 12 other states that already ban large capacity magazines. There's a lot more work to be done, but I think the fact that for the first time in many, many years, some gun safety legislation, although in my opinion minor, but yet it's a movement in the right direction. So I take my hat off to all those who work together to build and maintain community together and make sure that our siblings' problems are our problems and to solve them together. Ujima.
Mary Lee.
The principle of Kwanzaa, which has very much resonated with me this year and in this moment, is Ujima. And last year, we all ended up, I think, on very similar one, or many of us, which I think was Nia. And I'm interested now that we're ending up on Ujima, and I wonder what that means for us as we continue to speak with each other. This idea of collective work and responsibility to build and maintain our community together and make our brothers, sisters, and siblings problems our problems and to solve them together. I have so much shame and regret about the Asians who are involved here. I understand why it happens. I do not understand how it happens. And we as Asian Americans have to struggle with this. And we have to struggle with it mightily in order for us to come down on the right side of history and to understand who our community is. It is not the white community. Our adjacency to whiteness, our desire to assimilate into whiteness, our hopes to become white are simply not accurate. And wishing and hoping and taking actions such as we see with the Supreme Court won't make them true either. The other piece that that resonates for me, and you asked us about our favorite shows from last year, one of my favorite shows every year is the Happy Birthday Malcolm X and Yuri Kuchiyama.
Malcolm, can I shake your hands too? Because all these young people were. And you said, what for? And I didn't know first what to say. What for? I said, because what you're doing for your people. And he said, and what am I doing for my people? You're giving directions.
And I want to call out the Blue Scholars song, Yuri. That line of, when I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama.
Holla, swear to my kasamas. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. And if she ever hear this, it's an honor. Cause when I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama. Comma, serve the people proper. When I grow up, I wanna be just like Yuri Kochiyama.
When I grow up, I want to be just like Yuri Kuchiyama. And that relationship for me, I hold up in a number of ways because it speaks to two proud
individuals, not rejecting their communities, not rejecting their cultures, not rejecting the real differences and challenges between them, and still coming together in pursuit of the greater good, in pursuit of the common good, in pursuit of an understanding about our collective work and responsibility. So if there's anything I would leave us all with, is this past year has reminded me in so many ways about the work that still has to be done, and the places where the work has been done, where there is hope that we are coming together for a new and different future, understanding who our brothers, sisters, and siblings are, with a commitment to and responsibility of collectivity, revolutionary love, and moving the work forward.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Althea.
There were a few stories recently that I felt very much connected to a couple of the principles of Kwanzaa, one of which is unity. And this is one that's more recent, the story that this connects to for me, which is the Respect for Marriage Act passing in the Senate and seeing smooth sailing to a full passage with 12 Republicans on board. And as much divisiveness as we've seen, you know, sowed across this issue, the way that in the Supreme Court concurring opinion from Justice Thomas, there was an indication that same-sex marriage could be up for debate. The attacks that we've seen this year on trans youth, on trans healthcare, Don't Say Gay. This bill doesn't solve all of those things, but it does show a level of proactiveness, and I think it reflects the unity that this country actually has on that issue. I believe it's around 70-80% of people that believe same-sex marriage should be legal in the United States. Right now, it is protected by the Obergefell v. Hodges Supreme Court decision that legalized it in all states and territories. But heeding the warning of Clarence Thomas, I suppose, congressional Democrats have taken action to actually enshrine it in law and make it so that legal marriages performed in one state must be recognized by other states. And that extends to interracial marriage as well. They got 12 Republicans on board as included in that total. They came up with a filibuster-proof majority. And it is a sorry state of affairs that only 12 folks signed on in the Senate, but it is, I think, very notable because of how infrequently we see bipartisanship at all in Congress. To see this step towards unity, towards unifying our principles on this subject and the laws of this land, that they are not in the same kind of jeopardy that Roe v. Wade found itself in, and abortion rights for Americans, we saw that eroded this year. I think that that is an echo of unity. And I think it's also strategic about when that unity can be created, right? Democrats were intentional about holding this vote after the election, when there's ideally less pressure on Republicans to be extreme or to take a big stand about something like this for their constituents. And I think it points to the things that are the opposite of unifying for us as well, which is the way that elections are going right now. But outside of that context, we still see that lawmaking can happen and can be something unifying. So that was one that came to mind for me. Another principle of Kwanzaa is NIA, purpose. One story that I connected that to from 2022 was the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. It was obviously a wide-ranging bill, one that came together a lot, most of it out of the public eye, which I think is notable. But I notice, and I think it's worth highlighting, that it fights climate change with the purpose that many have highlighted for a long time, with putting priority to those who are most likely to be impacted. Now, of course, there's provisions that are not as far as climate activists want them to go, but there is a shift in the conversation. The purpose is that we must fight climate change and support the folks who are on the front lines of it, and recognize that it has this disparate impact, and that the conversation should not solely be about oil and gas or denying climate change, because we've seen in recent years just how accelerated these climate impacts are becoming. So I was glad to see a unity of purpose there and moving forward and acknowledging that that is the purpose that we have, and that, and not bickering over the small stuff that is not even a really honest conversation.
There is an overriding theme that 2022 represents: collective work and responsibility to build and maintain our community together and make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. Ujima, collective work and responsibility. The Kwanzaa Principle of 2022.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Listening to the news is experiencing one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we created a new segment to inspire. This segment is entitled, Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
A child shall lead them is a passage in Scripture which reminds us that oftentimes the leadership is found not in figures of authority, but where we may not think it is. A few weeks ago, I was teaching a lesson about the Golden Rule, a version of which is taught and affirmed in many religions: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. As I was teaching that class, this young girl, 7 years old, was looking at me with a very quizzical face. And Jania raised her hand and had something to say. So I stopped myself and say, okay, Jania, what do you have to say? Because this is important. We have to know how to treat one another. And Jania said, well, in my school, we don't use the Golden Rule, we use the Platinum Rule. Now, the Platinum Rule was popularized in Dr. Tony Alessandro's book of the same name. And the Platinum Rule goes this way: treat others the way they want to be treated. I think that this is appropriate because it centers not on the self, but on the other. In the light of so much violence, specifically I'm thinking of anti-trans rhetoric and violence, I think it's appropriate for us to enter the new year with the desire to act with respect and allow others to define who they are, to love who they want, and to affirm and to for all to embrace one another. And that it is not only appropriate for our interaction with other sentient beings, but with creation itself. Treat creation as creation wants to be treated. The creation is crying out for humanity to stop destroying the creation. Children throughout the world are crying out for the end of war and violence and hunger.
Okay, so the golden rule basically says do unto others as you would have them do unto yourself, right? It works under the basic principle that we all want to be treated the same. But sometimes that doesn't really work out very well, right? It doesn't take into consideration how we identify or our culture, right? When I was in college, I didn't even realize how important it was to know identifications or the importance of cultural identity. I just thought, I am who I am and you are who you are, and that's cool. But it wasn't that way. When I was in college, I got called a dark spot in the snow. People used to insult me all the time. I went to a predominantly white institution, and sometimes it felt like an intentionally white institution. And a lot of the things that people would say that they found funny, I found racist. And not the game that the guys would spit to me and my girlfriends was lame, but it was also sexist. So we really struggled. There was a huge divide between the communities and the culture. And as a first-gen college student, so someone who had no parents or family who had gone to college before, I didn't know how to communicate those issues, right? I really struggled with telling people, don't treat me like that. That's not okay. You're being disrespectful, and I'm not okay with you using that type of language. It was really hard. And when I tried, sometimes the administration and the people that I would talk to said, it's a part of life. That's bullying. You're just being too sensitive. Grow some tougher skin. But that's not true. That's the wrong message to send. It's an alternative fact. So what you need to understand is that you have the right to stand up for yourself, and you have the right to embrace all that you are by owning your humanity. Now, what does that mean? It means self-love and giving more love and having a positive impact in society by embracing others. You may not always understand how another person identifies, but that's why it's important to be able to check yourself and communicate with others effectively. So how do we do that? Author H.P. Newquist says that the brain, in its full developmental capacity, weighing nearly 3 pounds, gives us an amazing gift to critically think. Now, what does that mean? It means that we have the right and the ability to process things, to be really intentional about how we take information in and how we give information out. Then UCLA professor Matthew Lieberman, in his book, Social, How Humans Are Wired to Connect, states that the lifelong passion of humans is connection. So if we put those together, we're thinking critically, and then we want to connect with people. So we should think critically about how to connect with people in a positive way, how to support one another and engage one another and give more love to one another. And that's owning your humanity, right? It's uplifting each other, uplifting your next person next to you. You may not know the person next to you, right? So look to your left. Maybe that's your friend. Look to your right. Maybe that's your classmate. But do you know how they fully identify holistically? You may not know their gender, right? So whether or not they're feminine, masculine, cis, or trans. You may not know their sexual orientation. You may not know their disability or if they're able-bodied, because not all identities are visible, right? So I've had the privilege to be the student, the teacher, and the administrator. And you don't see those identities on me. A lot of times people mislabel me all the time, and they stereotype me. And what's a stereotype? It's when we make assumptions. And we do it all the time, right? You're walking in class, you're in the hallway, and maybe you see a girl with a brand name bag, and you think, oh, she got money. Look at her, look at that brand name bag. Or you see the student with the always raising his hand, and he always has the A's. You think, oh my God, he must be such a nerd. Or the teacher with the accent must be an immigrant, right? We think those things, but they're so wrong. We're always making assumptions, and we need to check how we think about people. We don't know anything about these people. Maybe the girl with the brand name bag, that could have been a gift. Maybe she actually works 3 jobs just to make it to high school and is trying really hard to get to college. And you know why that's a possibility? Because that was me. When I was in high school, I got my first Coach bag. And it's a Coach bag that I still carry to this day. And I worked 3 jobs. I came from a lower socioeconomic status. I lived in the projects. And I tried really hard to make it to college. College was my pathway out. And so the only way I was going to do that was by working really hard. So I traveled 5 hours every day to go to school and back, round trip. And then I also worked three jobs. It's really important. You have to find your way and make your way and not let anybody else stereotype you. But they do, because people used to always think, oh, you got money. And I didn't have no money. I didn't even have any savings to go to college. So it's really important that you always find a way to not stereotype. Sometimes when we stereotype threat. Stereotype threatening is basically when you have someone live up to the stereotype. So all the times that you continue to tell somebody negative images, they start to live up to that hype. So for example, you give negative messages daily, right? So social psychologist Claude Steele says that that's a microaggression. Microaggressions are the daily negative messages that we give to each other. So sometimes it's in humor. Sometimes people use jokes and they're like, oh, can I touch your hair? I want to touch your hair. How's that look? Or you look really cute today. And there's all types of hate in those messages, right? You're wondering like, ooh, something's wrong with you. There's all types of hate, but it's not direct. It's not upfront. It's all subliminal and indirect. Those are microaggressions. And a lot of times they do add up. And the person who's receiving all of that feels some type of way, especially when it comes to language, identification, the way we carry ourselves. So we need to be able to bridge the gap and ask questions and check ourselves. Dr. Laura Brené would say we would do that with intercultural communication. Now that sounds like a super spiffy theory, but it's really simple. It's basically just finding ways to communicate between the cultures. And how you do that is really simple. You see a person, you don't necessarily know how they identify, you're confused about something, so you sincerely ask. There is no dumb question. I'm sure you hear that all the time in school. There's no dumb question. You don't understand something, have a conversation. You want to know something more about something, just do it. Intercultural communication happens all the time, but we need to be intentional about it, right? We need to critically think, like Newquist says, so that we can build that connection the way Lieberman says. And that's really important. You probably do that with your parents all the time. Think about it. The language you use, this idea of varying English, it's true. The things that you say now, I'm gonna get lit. Your parents didn't use lit, they used dope, or they used cool. It's so different. You use Facebook now as a tool to connect. They didn't have that. They didn't even have cell phones, most of them. They had handsets connected to the walls. Y'all looking at me like, I don't know what that is. Because there's a difference in generation, and it's really important that you understand the difference and you build those connections with everybody. It's really important to check your assumptions and build the bridges within the cultures. You also need to make sure that you're not microaggressing, which we do all the time. And it's hard, right? Owning your humanity is not always so simple, especially when the nation is telling you that certain lives don't matter, when global warming is taking away our resources, when terrorism is on the rise. Now it's more complex than ever to try to stay positive. But the reality is that you need to be able to do that. When I was in college, it would have been easy to retaliate. I grew up in the hood, we could have fought. But this, the thing, I didn't want to lose my scholarship, right? I had an 80% scholarship to go to college. I didn't want to lose that. That was more important to me. Leaving the hood was more important to me so that I could make it out there. And that's what I'm saying. You need to make sure that you prioritize what's going to be your story. What's going to be the way that you connect with the world? How are you going to fulfill your passions? And how are you going to make a positive impact with each other? What's going to be your footprint? Not just your carbon footprint, but the footprint that you leave when you think about your next steps. Some of you talked about going to college. Some of you are thinking about going into the work field, and that's great. But the only way you can do that is making sure that you build those connections, because it's so important to have a community of people behind you. Don't forget about the person next to you. Don't forget about the family that you have. Don't forget about the people that are going to be coming up behind you. That's so important. So instead of treating people how you think they should be treated, make sure that you ask the question, how do you like to be called? What's the way I can best respect you? How do you like to be appreciated? Because that matters. And every time that somebody mistreats you, think about that. We don't always walk in the same footsteps, right? We don't always wear each other's shoes. And if you ever wonder if that's true, sometimes you drive up 690 East and West, people have the signs out there, sometimes they don't have shoes. So always let that be a reminder. We don't walk in each other's shoes because sometimes we don't even have the shoes to share each other's footprints. Make sure that you're always building community, and when you don't know how to do that, just ask the question. That's the platinum rule. Forget the golden rule.
And so I think a hope is to hear those voices and to treat others the way they want to be treated. That, for me, is hope as I begin the new year.
Thank you, Reverend Cecil. Professor Johnson, hope is a thing with feathers.
A new discovery that has the potential of eliminating opioid deaths and overdoses. And this was something that's been being worked on by Dr. Colin Hale. It's like a three-dose shot. They're referring to it as a vaccine, but it prevents the brain basically from succumbing to overdose or death for the use of drugs, these particular drugs, these synthetic drugs. We have had a lot of lip service about trying to address the opioid crisis in the United States. In the 12 months ending in January of 2022, we had 107,000 people die from drug overdoses. These increases from 2019 to 2021 have been 340%. And the age group is our most important age group in our population, 25 to 34. These are people who should be moving into a very productive time in their life. And the fact that we now have an opportunity to save those lives, coupled with what I hope will be an increase in therapy and mental health, this is a very significant discovery.
Over the last 5 years, University of Houston Associate Professor Colin Hale has been in the lab working on a vaccine targeting fentanyl with a research team. Researchers say the vaccine can block fentanyl from entering the brain, eliminating the drug's high and helping to prevent an overdose.
This vaccine is totally different. Following vaccination, you develop antibodies against the chemical.
Here's how it works. The vaccine generates anti-fentanyl antibodies that bind to fentanyl when consumed.
If they were vaccinated, they would have antibodies on board when they leave, and the antibodies would prevent them from overdosing.
My item for Hope is a Thing with Feathers is the protests that are happening right now in China against repression, against COVID restrictions, against media suppression and free speech suppression. And what gives me great, great hope is that this is happening through the energy of young people, and it is happening under such risk of imprisonment and violence. And it's so clever. People are identifying themselves as the A4 revolution, so capital A and then four and then revolution, which speaks to the size of the blank white papers that these people are holding in front of their mouths as an act of rebellion and an act of resistance and a way in which to make their voices heard, even in anonymity, even in silence, and even in a lack of ability to make any sound at all. These young people are protesting in a country where we didn't think we would ever see the kind of resistance that we saw, for instance, in the Tiananmen Square rebellion. Gives me great hope for what to come, is that even in these repressive situations where the ability to even connect with each other has been taken away, people still find a way. Hope still finds a way. The work and justice still finds a way. The work and justice still finds a way.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race.
On this episode of Let's Talk About Race, the panel shares the history of voter suppression in the United States, which is as American as apple pie. With the 2022 midterms and all other elections, is the concept of one person, one vote, the cornerstone of democracy, still a thing? Let's talk about race. One person, no vote.
How does voter suppression operate? Where does it come from in American history, and where is it now?
Voter suppression has been a part of our democracy in this country from its inception.
Voter suppression has really been a part of American history from the very beginning.
Those who participated in this experiment in democracy were all property owners. They limited the access to power and to decision making from the very beginning of this democracy. There has been a move to increase voter participation and to increase the reality of citizens' participation in our society. So since that time of the founding of the Republic, we've witnessed the removal of the necessity to own property to vote, the granting of citizenship and the right to vote to formerly enslaved men came about with the 15th Amendment. In the 20th century, women gained the ability to vote. The 1965 Voting Rights Bill further expanded voting opportunity. And all these things created a situation where more and more people were able to participate in this experiment called democracy. Many citizens in all over the United States are battling efforts to restrict voting access and the ability for people to participate in the decision-making process in this nation.
I think we see it in both individual and systemic manifestations. It's a long continuum. So you have individual intimidation, you have ways in which people are challenged, and then you see the systems that are in place that include gerrymandering and some of the intimidation, the time and place restrictions that people are putting on voting boxes and when people can vote and how votes get collected and by whom. And you have in some places these vigilante police being funded and basically sent out to do whatever they want related to their opinion of whether voting is happening correctly or not happening correctly. I think we have to understand that our ancestors died for the right to vote. And that struggle has never gone away.
They left the actual management of the vote to the states. And that's where the problem comes in, because not all states treated voting in the same manner. And this is a problem that we're struggling with now. So you asked about voter suppression and how it operates. I think it's changed over time. The intent has been to disenfranchise certain parts of the population. And they've done that in different ways. For example, in Mississippi in 1892, everyone could vote. They wound up with two black senators and then decided that wasn't going to work out for them and instituted a grandfather clause, which said that the people that were permitted to vote was anyone whose grandfather was qualified to vote. So that clearly left out 90% of the black population. That's an example of targeting and excluding certain groups of people to manipulate the outcome. It wasn't until 1964, which has really been 60 years, basically, since outlawed poll taxes. And that's something to think about, just 60 years, even though we supposedly had the right to vote, you know, since 1776. There have been efforts to broaden and include more diverse population, but you always have this sort of reeling back trying to exclude certain groups. What we see now is, again, another effort to manipulate the outcome of elections. And it's almost been reduced to basically, if I didn't win, then the election was a fraud.
It may be facially neutral. The types of laws about voting that are attempted to be passed across this country, but they are targeted at specific people. Voter ID laws, for example, can make it extremely hard to vote if you're trans or non-binary. In Georgia, they were passing laws about not allowing folks to bring food or water to those waiting in line to vote, or eliminating Sunday voting. In other parts of the country, they've made their residency requirements or having a physical address much more strict, and that in its own way targets Native populations who often don't have the same address set up on reservations. All of these things, taken in a vacuum with no context, with no historical knowledge, maybe that's fine, but understanding the history, understanding what it is that is the goal here, which is controlling electoral outcomes, mind you, not by coming up with policies that are preferred by the majority of voters, which is hypothetically one way you could try to win, but instead manipulating the true will of the people.
Some people, quite honestly, do not believe in democracy, and they are feel emboldened to say that out loud.
This idea of we need fewer voters, but we need better voters. I think we understand what the code language is for who is a better voter and who is not. This dynamic rests in a couple of things. It rests in the great replacement theory, which is such an underlying base belief for the radical right. And that's buttressed by white supremacy culture, which says the better voters are the white voters. You see this through the disenfranchisement of people with felony convictions. And we know that the criminal justice system is not fair. It is discriminatory to people of color. All of these are not coincidences. That's not by accident. And it certainly flies in the face of one person, one vote, our democracy, our popular practices are the will of the people. That is not democracy. We have a very cynical view, and I would say, particularly for the radical right, a lack of really belief in democracy. Although I don't think people used to say this, more and more people are saying, I don't believe in democracy because I don't believe that those people are good enough, smart enough, righteous enough, whatever the enough is, to be able to have the privilege of voting, and that should be reserved for people like me and the people who believe the way I believe. And you said something, Althea, which I thought was very, you know, they can't trust that their agenda is compelling enough or important enough or persuasive enough that it could win on its own. They have to take these steps and these measures in order to ensure that their perspective and their agenda will be the one that prevails.
It is amazing that countries throughout the world over the past 100, 150 years have often looked to the United States, not because the United States was perfect, but because it created a document, the U.S. Constitution, based on a vision of how people could live that allow people to dream and to say we can create something similar in our society. And that was a dream. But what happens, as Langston Hughes says, when a dream is deferred? What happens when we abandon the dream? That is what we are experiencing in recent decades.
We have moved away from what is the common good. The concept of what is good for the majority of people, and the individual agendas have taken over. Part of the reason I think we've lost the common good, we are now looking at a voting population that really has never been called upon to embrace that concept. And part of that, I think, is education. Part of that is our political maneuvering that's gone on. Part of that is white supremacy that has taken over in our institutions. There's a lot to unpack for why this has happened. If we don't figure out a way to align people around the common good, then the inevitable will happen and democracy will fail.
Democracy is envisioned as the antidote to the tyranny of the few. Democracy isn't going well if there is significant concentration of political power in the hands of the few. In terms of who should vote, who shouldn't vote, if you believe in democracy, people should be able to vote. We should not have political power concentrated in the hands of the few. We should not have decision-making authority. No taxation without representation, right? Like, that's the first thing you learn. They tell you that one in second grade. The consent of the governed is an important concept, theoretically. If you want to make some change in your community, you should have community consensus to make that happen. And democracy is how we've envisioned that.
I think the first thing that we can do to start to arrest this kind of decline is, first of all, admit to it. Be concrete. Say, yeah, we did it. It was wrong and we shouldn't do it again. The second thing would be to make the commitment that even if we saw the advantage for quote unquote our side, we won't take it. We would measure ourselves by the common good. We would measure ourselves by the greater benefit to the most. And I think the third thing that we have to do is we have to vote.
Those were excerpts from our show, Let's Talk About Race.
One person, no vote.
Thanks for taking a look back with us. All of our previous episodes can be found online by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR, and listen to us regularly on your local community radio station.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Happy Kwanzaa, everyone, and thank you for listening.
We need unity, self-determination, collective work and economic opportunity.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I'd like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroots News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcast or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Goodbye.
Another politician sitting far away. This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, time.